This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Lana. Thanks for joining me today in my first program of 2015. I took some much-needed time off and disconnected as much as I could for a few weeks. And it's always a rude awakening opening that email program or news website after some time away. You know what I'm talking about. But the battle must continue. There's no honor and courage in vacationing your life away, right? My guest is Robert Davis, a professor of Italian Renaissance and pre-modern Mediterranean history at Ohio State University. He is best known for his research into the Mediterranean slave trade and has written two books on the topic. We'll discuss Christian slaves, Muslim masters, white slavery in the Mediterranean, the Barbary Coast, and Italy. We'll hear about the bondage of Europeans by North African Muslims that flourished during the same centuries as the heyday of the transatlantic slave trade. And yes, there were white slaves in America during this time, too. His book is among the very few that actually delve into the extent of the Barbary Coast slave trade. So stick around, there's an hour to go. Bob, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, as we begin and get warmed up, so tell us what caused you to research into Christian Muslim slavery in the early modern Mediterranean.
It was a funny thing. I was, as a graduate student, I was studying about 25 years ago or so, or I guess it's 30 years ago now, shipbuilding in Venice. My original area of study is Venice, Italy. And I was looking at a bunch of petitions from shipbuilders about asking for things and telling their life stories, a very interesting source. And I was kind of puzzled at first to find not thousands, but dozens of mentions of the fact that these shipbuilders had been enslaved and had gotten out of slavery. And they considered this something worthy of bringing to the notice of the state. And I did not realize that Venetians had been enslaved. And I sort of thought of that. And I went back to writing about shipbuilders, but a couple years later, 5 years later or so, I decided to look into it more and discovered there was this whole world out there of enslavement that was taking place. That is, enslavement by usually what we call Barbary corsairs, who were taking, capturing various nations of ships, of Christian nations primarily, in Europe and enslaving their crews. And so I decided to start investigating this, and that eventually took me on other trips to Italy, took me to Rome primarily, and also to Naples and Genoa, Venice, Palermo, all the cities really in Italy that had big fleets, to see how this worked out, how the sort of practical matter. I was interested. It's always interesting for an historian to discover a topic that is not heavily written about, mm-hmm. heavily researched. And the research that I found was almost exclusively by other Italians, certainly to do with Italy. I did some work in Spanish and French sources as well. But the English and Americans didn't really have much to say about it. And so it was not something that we tended to know much about in English.
Well, let's pretend we're talking to a room full of students who have never heard about Christian slavery in Europe. So where's the best place to begin to shed light on this history?
My response has often been, I think the most effectively, is to point out the numbers involved. We are more or less aware of the number of Africans that were enslaved and taken to America, well, taken to the New World, actually, because only a minority of them were taken to, a very small minority, to modern-day
That's right.
United States. But of those who were taken to America, there's something on the order of 11 million, just very roughly. More of them, far more of that number were captured, but only about 11 million actually probably made it to the United States. And I discovered that the Barbary corsairs alone, that is ranging from Morocco over to Libya, took something on the order of 1 million to 1.25 million slaves in roughly that same period of time. Not the same dimensions, really, in the same order of magnitude, but still a lot of slaves, it seemed to me. We're talking about serious numbers. So I tell students, you know, there were over 1 million. Since then, I've done more research and realized that actually there were far more slaves taken in Eastern Europe, or at least as many slaves. So altogether, we're looking at some millions were taken. So it was a significant problem and kind of interesting in that it's not a problem that's really generally known about.
And what time period are we talking about here?
Well, actually, it's an interesting thing that I also tell students is that the two forms of slavery started almost exactly at the same time, and almost exactly for the same reason. Although slavery was the enslavement of black people, more precisely, the slavery of Muslims actually goes back to the Crusades. There was always a problem in the Christian world. Should Christians be allowed to enslave other people? And it was decided sort of tacitly that Christians were allowed to enslave heathens. They couldn't enslave other Christians, but they could enslave heathens. And that was understood as sort of from the law of war, that you could reasonably enslave your captives. And that is, by enslaved, I mean basically not just take them away as captives, but sell them. And force them to stay with you, but also potentially ransom them or have them sold back to their native countries. Well, the thing is that this was actually only ever made into, I don't remember the exact date, a pontifical law. I think it was Pope Nicholas V. I think it was in the 1460s or 70s, decided to allow the Portuguese who were exploring down into Africa, that it was all right for them to capture heathen slaves. That was seen as all right. But there were also Muslims in the way. They were part of the Muslim enslavement tradition that they started doing that. Muslims, of course, also enslaved Christians in exchange. But the reason I say the two are connected is you may remember the date 1492. Well, what happened in 1492?
Columbus.
I'm asking you. Yes, Columbus. Columbus goes to the New World, and in the course of that, opens up the need to develop the New World when American Indians don't prove successful at forced labor. Within a fairly short amount of time, the Spanish and Portuguese are bringing African slaves to the New World, and Columbus and the need to develop the New World stimulates this. But people don't remember often something else that happened in 1492. And in fact, the reason that Columbus was sent in the first place was the final conquest of Spain, of Andalusia, by King and Queen Ferdinand and Isabel. And in part of the conquest of Andalusia, they drove a large number of remaining Moors, the people who lived in this part of Spain, into what became known as Morocco, and across the straits into Spain. Those people went to Spain, went to Morocco, went to Africa, went to Algiers, as often very angry people. They were defeated. They were not happy. And they set about almost immediately, we're talking about within a generation, by 1510, 1515, systematically attacking the coasts of Spain, corsairs, who begin, starting with this guy named Barbarossa, Redbeard, attacking the Spanish islands, the big islands, and the coast of Spain itself, and carrying off Spaniards into slavery. So we have the same event almost start slavery in both sides of the world. It's kind of fascinating in a way. These people are looking for revenge, but they're also very soon find that they found a profitable business carrying off slaves. At the same time, of course, there's this somewhat and then increasingly more systematic enslavement of Africans to take them off to America.
Yeah, I think only it was actually under 400,000 that actually made it to America. The rest went to South America and the Caribbean, and a lot of them died, of
right.
course.
Yeah, so it's roughly 4 million to the Caribbean, 4 million to Brazil, and then the rest to Spanish. So it's a small amount when you consider, but there were differences, and the slaves in America managed to, their population went up faster than other places, partly because they were actually somewhat better treated than they were in the Caribbean. They were allowed to have children, so they reproduced more. But in any case, yeah, there's this kind of vast flow of people begins to start through enforced labor, both from Africa, from Africa to America, and from Europe to Africa, which is kind of a nice symmetry, as it were.
Well, if we talk about the Barbary pirates, I've read that their raids were so devastating that coastal areas were pretty much abandoned, even as far as Iceland, capturing women and children. So how did this unfold? Did these pirates just surprise these areas one day and catch everyone off guard, or what happened?
Well, initially, yeah. Part of the reason was that Italy was a very divided area. It was very broken up into small principalities and other statelets and whatnot. And so it was initially hard for the Italians to defend themselves. Also, a large part of Italy, everything from Naples on down to Sicily, was kind of a colony of Spain and was kind of neglected. It was not, they didn't put a lot into the defense of the place. So in particular, for example, the coast of southern Italy was really depopulated. And if you go to Italy now, go to southern Italy, go to Sicily, drive around the coast, you can see one of the main solutions that the government tried to install. Every couple of miles, you can still see these watchtowers that they put up. And the ideal was that the watchtowers could communicate, usually by lighting fires, sort of like Lord of the Rings. They could communicate to one another. They didn't expect to actually serve as fortresses, but more as just to communicate. And if they could communicate to any nearby or any big city at any distance, they could then get the cavalry out. And basically, the cavalry was the only thing that could stop the raiders. Because otherwise, these places were just undefended. There was really nobody there. But it was a long time coming. And in fact, as late as the 1570s and 80s, in other words, like 100 years almost after this started, the Moors, the corsairs, were running raids right up to the mouth, into the mouth of the Tiber. In other words, within about 10 miles of Rome. They were that close to the capital of the Christian world. They were actually carrying off people. And I have found some interesting cases of police. I mean, they're so close to Rome that actually the case is investigated by the Roman city police rather than some sort of statewide organization, because it's a local attack, right? So, and the reason you mentioned Iceland, that's one of the more bizarre, interesting cases. This is in 1627. And, the story is that it actually came up, the possibility of this raid, because these people, this particular crew of corsairs, had snagged a ship on which there were some Icelandic seamen, and they enslaved them, of course. And one of them, to get out of his enslavement, said, "Well, I can tell you where to go, where there is nobody will ever expect you. It's called Iceland."
Oh, no.
And they said, "Oh, well, sounds good to us." Well, actually, and that's another thing we should probably mention, is that the captain of the ship was actually a Dutchman who had turned Turk, as they say, who had changed his religion, a rinnegato, as the Italians would call them, or renegade. And he said, "Sure, let's do it." And so they sailed up there, actually went to a conference there once. And it was very strange, because those people on this island called Heimaey off the coast of Iceland still remember that attack, still sort of point out the scenes where it took place, and still sort of, you know, have sort of this group memory. There actually was a saga written about it at some point, so it's kind of part of the national memory of Iceland.
Yeah, I was thinking the pirates must have been working in cahoots with some Europeans who possibly helped facilitate and transport the white slaves into the Muslim world, right?
To some extent, it's a complicated roundabout business. There were certainly Europeans who were interested. I mean, Europeans mostly got involved in ransoming slaves. And one way to look at this whole thing, in fact, is, and this might be moving too far or too fast, but one way you can look at this, partly because this is what the historical record tells us about, is the ransoming of slaves. This becomes a huge industry, and it becomes one of the most expectable, regular religious activities in the Christian world, not just in the Catholic world, but in the Protestant world as well. There will be somebody out there walking the streets, in the churches, during the various Lenten sermons, when priests will be talking about matters to do with, you know, forgiveness and expiation and sin, that someone will be saying, "Remember the poor slaves, remember the poor slaves," and they'll walk around with a box that has that slogan on it, and they'll be collecting money, this vast amounts of money. It's a huge wealth transfer from Europe to North Africa Because slaves are expensive. Slaves are very expensive back then. They're comparable in price to what they were in America. And it's just kind of surprising. I mean, you could say in today's money, if such a thing could make any sense in talking about today's money and their money, that a slave could easily cost back then in, say, Italy, 50 to 100 ducats, which would be the equivalent of $8,000 maybe. So it's not only... it's a worthwhile thing, but it's also very, very difficult. If someone goes and makes a raid and holds off 200 slaves, you're looking at 100,000 $100,000, $150,000.
I want to know, what was their motive for capturing Christian slaves?
Well, I've sort of figured out, I mean, this is nobody ever said this is why we did it. Right? One thing you have to keep in mind is this is a very vexed topic, partly because the records from the Corsair point of view, the Muslim point of view, are extremely limited. So consequently, we're looking at a very one-sided kind of vision of things. It's very ironic in a way, because many people who research American slavery have always been sorry that so few slaves were able to write about their experience and to write about their feelings, so that those few that did, much is made of them, and they're much studied and talked about and so forth. But here the opposite is true. The slaves have a lot to say, but the captors don't. So we really don't know what these people are up to, what the captors, what the corsairs are doing. But we can deduce fairly logically. First of all, there's a lot of money in it. It's definitely a thing of profit. These people can expect to get, as I say, something on the order in today's money, $8,000, even $10,000 a slave, and for certain select categories of slaves, much more. And that's for ransom. But you can also, that's assuming you're going to ransom them back. But a lot of slaves never got ransomed back, and they just stayed in the hands of people. So they worked. So another good thing is using them for labor, and these become slave societies, classic slave societies, where people expect to have slaves in many places. Even rather ordinary people, you know, like a baker, for example, might have a Christian slave in his bakery or so forth, and grinding the grain by hand, apparently a very annoying task. you just grind, or pound it in a mortar and pestle, and so this is the thing. I mean, if the whole society, everybody's got a slave, then you got to have slaves, right? Or you're not competitive. Another thing, though, is that people often would have slaves and then rent them out, so that even if you didn't have slaves, you would rent slaves from an owner to do various kinds of tasks around town. Also, slaves, however, and this is not something that was generally realized until fairly recently, a lot of slaves were actually sent out to work in kind of small plantations in the countryside. The northern part of Algeria and Tunis are pretty fertile areas, and these were widely developed, mostly using slave labor, growing all kinds of nice crops that you can't grow in cold, nasty Europe. So there's another thing that they did. And finally, I guess, and this is never to be sneezed at, that these people realized they were putting a finger in the eye of Christianity. They were taking Christians, enslaving them, and showing the obvious superiority of Islam to Christianity. Even as they well knew, they were depriving Christianity and the Christian nations of important workers. The great majority of slaves were probably, I there's no way of knowing this, but I think the majority of slaves were probably either fishermen or sailors, because they were the most accessible.
Yeah, I was wondering what they were most in demand for what traits or abilities.
Yeah, they were in demand, but they're also available. I mean, because they're out there on their ships, small ships, defenseless ships. They even used to send out Corsair fleets into the North Atlantic and capture the English herring trade, or sorry, the cod trade. As the cod fishermen came back from Newfoundland, they would pick them off because fishermen are just easy to catch and are by their very nature, in the course of fishing, kind of defenseless. So there's this harm that they're doing to the societies, and it's demoralizing, of course, because they're able to snatch away there.
And then, of course, the beautiful white women were stolen as concubines and forced into sex slavery, of course.
Well, of course. Don't really know. It's hard to say. The numbers are not too clear. It would seem, if we look at the ransoming lists, and there are actually lists from the Catholic ransoming societies that can be extremely long. There can be cases of ransoming 400 or 500 people at a time. This really means the equivalent of several million dollars in cash in our monetary worth. But of those, when you see these lists, it's like women are like 5% of the total. A very small number. So this has led some people to think, some scholars to think, that women were irrelevant to this whole equation, which is interesting. I have thought, it occurs to me, that women do not show up on the ransom list because they were not ransomed. That is, if you have this, as you mentioned, attractive white-skinned concubine, you might not want to sell her. And I have found a few cases of people sort of hiding them, people complaining about the fact they can't, priests, for example, complaining they can't get to these people that are, after all, they're in the harem, they're secluded. And it's possible that the numbers are higher. The numbers are nowhere near more than 30%, I would say. But they,
well, and not everything's going to be in records all the time, of course.
Yeah. Well, things just vanish. You don't know. It's true that except when women are taken on ships, they're most often ransomed fairly quickly, and they're not taken off and raped or put in the harem or anything. Even some of them are lucky enough to stay later in this story, to stay in the houses of the local English or French council, who can sort of give them familiar company. But it is still true, especially in the beginning of this period, in the early 16th century, but right on through the whole period, that there still are raids on shore. And some of the ones that I looked at, as I mentioned, that are close to Rome, they carry off a fair number of women. So those have to end up somewhere. I know one raid the 1720s was near a town in southern Italy where they went off with, 20, 30 people. It was a huge, exciting thing. And everybody in Rome was all upset about it. And I don't think they got most of the women back. Mm. They just didn't come back. Also, likewise, the Icelandic one, they didn't get those people back.
Yeah, I wonder if the Berber blondes in Northern Africa are actually descendants of these European slaves.
Yeah, maybe. It's just a few. I mean, we're always fascinated by that possibility, but there's a drawback in this, and that is that, at least as far as the men go, it was a supposed story that the men were not allowed to have sex with anybody. They couldn't have sex with any Christian women, because they were all locked away in one capacity, either waiting for ransom or in a harem. They couldn't have sex with Muslim women because that was completely against the Quran, especially if they had children. So they could, as I understand the Quran, which is certainly not as an expert, but it was often cited that if they were found in a liaison with a Muslim woman, they would be in serious trouble. And this left very few possible outlets if they wanted one. And so the result of this is that they did not leave, unlike, say, Africans in the United States, they did not leave any kind of, very little gene pool behind, very little resonance of their existence.
I think it's interesting that Southern Europeans are darker in appearance, especially in like Italy, Greece, and Spain, where they used to be more fair-skinned and had lighter hair. And so I think you can definitely see how the Northern African blood or admixture is still there.
There could be some. Yeah, there could be some. That's true. There's Greek population, certainly for longstanding in Southern Italy. That could be. It's not easy to figure out. Somebody could go there and do a DNA test, I suppose, of course. That's if there were particular markers. I do know, someone said, what was it, about 20 years after the Icelandic capture, somebody reported that there were all these very confused, very blonde, sunburned people walking around Algiers who were just there, just looking, and they could not get back. Some groups, like the Icelandic and some other groups I've heard of, were sort of allowed to remain together as groups, interestingly enough, as they belonged to one particular owner, I guess. But no one expected Billy to ransom these people back. So you were basically there for life, and then increasingly over the course of the 17th and into the 18th century, these church organizations begin to get it together, very difficult organizational task to raise the money to ransom them out. And at a certain point by the mid-18th century, they were actually ransoming them faster than they could be captured. And they slowed it down considerably. They lowered the level of enslavement considerably by their success.
Now, according to some of the accounts that you've read, what was the experience for slaves in private versus state custody? Were there big differences there?
There could be. It's tricky because there's a kind of an overlap where slaves could easily end up having very much the same life, because both kinds could be rented out. The state had its own. Let's say, first of all, initially the main use for male slaves was rowing galleys. That's why we have the image of the galley slave today. There was one in a New Yorker cartoon, as a constant reoccurring motif. That was what they mostly did. And it was considered extremely hard, difficult, wretched, and probably fatal work. It was also, one must admit, widely diffused in the northern shore of the Mediterranean, in France, Italy. Even the papacy had its galleys. And it was commonly in the north, in Europe, used as a punishment for convicts. They didn't have prison, so they would send people to the galleys for 10 years or something like that. In Barbary, this was the common use of state slaves. Although I should parenthetically say that private owners would sometimes, or in fact often, rent their slaves out to a galley captain when he needed, because it took, for a good sized galley, for an average sized galley, it would take 80, 100 rowers, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And for a big state galley, it could take close to 200. So it was necessary for these people, necessary for the captains to always get these people, and it was expensive to rent them, cost a lot of money. So some of the very biggest private slave owners would have their own fleet. And they would keep their own slaves. And this becomes a distinguishing feature of state versus private slavery. Private slavery, not surprisingly, unless you're rented out, you live in the home of your master. And this can be good or bad. A number of the stories of slave narratives that we have, they talk about that, the good and the bad of that, how they suffered and how they didn't at the hands of cruel masters. But it probably doesn't compare to the difficulties in being a state slave, because then you're put in a place called a baño, which is just Spanish for a bath. And supposedly, originally, the first baño was in Algiers, and it was started when Barbarossa was so successful, bringing back literally thousands of slaves with every voyage, that, as they used to say, you could buy a Christian for an onion. They were so cheap that they needed to be put somewhere. And so then, in kind of an emergency, they converted an old bathhouse, a hammam, to a slave quarters. Those are, hammam is sort of closed in, and so it sort of made sense. And then they subsequently started building ones that are made purposely for holding slaves. And none of these exist that I know of anymore, but they were large 3-4-story cubes, kind of open courtyards in the middle. And they're just basically big slave prisons. You're allowed out either to go on assigned jobs or to find work for yourself every morning at sunrise, and you're locked up again every night. Those who go out on assigned tasks, not on galleys, are usually chained together and sort of, they, you know, in a chain gang, chink their way around the city. They work on the docks, is a popular place, which is kind of a state enterprise, building and maintaining the docks. They go out to quarries out in the countryside and dig stone, big blocks of stone, which are often then hauled into the harbor and thrown in the water to make a breakwater. Some of them are taken up into the hills to cut lumber, or other. They go to salt mines, literally salt mines, not very pleasant. and things like that. And they're interestingly, by and large, except for they get a meal when they're out on in the at their work out in the town, around the town. They also do building, various construction jobs. They're given a piece of bread or something, but they're not fed. So what they do is they come back by and large like an hour or so before, 2 hours, let's say, before they close the doors to the banyo, and have to go about somehow making the money to get the food to feed themselves. And not only that, they also have to get the money to pay for a place to stay in the banyo. And so, well, it's not uncommon, actually, in European prisons, you had to pay for your accommodations as well. But this is privatization. This is what we have in a non-state-run enterprise, because it is all privatized out. So they did various things. I mean, as I have found that they ran taverns in the banyo, because good Muslims could not drink alcohol. But Turks, who were sort of the ruling class in many of these cities, did like to drink, not all of them, but some. And so they would run taverns where Turks, Christians of various sorts who were free in the city, who wanted to, Jews who were in large numbers in the cities, could go get a drink, very popular hangouts, sort of like those taverns in Pirates of the Caribbean, I think. And they would they make money there. They would do various kinds of jobs, or they would steal. They would go out and just steal anything they could, basically lay hands on. And they were notorious. As one slave owner said, "My slaves have hooks for fingers." And it's interesting, the way that the slave owners kept from paying to maintain their slaves was by foisting them off on less fortunate Arabs, Moors, Turks, and Jews out in the city, who they robbed every way they could. If they were caught, they were beaten, but that's about the end of it, because the owner said, "What can I do? So they would whatever they could grab, you know, rip something off a washing line, take a pie out of a window, or whatever, they would take back pots and pans, they'd take back to the banyo, and at a certain time they would close the doors. Before they close the doors, they would sort of make an announcement, there's going to be a sale, and all the people who were interested, including those who just had their stuff stolen, would come into the banyo, and they would bid on the merchandise that was for sale, and with that money the slaves then could support themselves.
Now, according to your research, were most of these slaves worked to death, or could they have children? What was their life like? The conditions, and were they valued?
Yeah, they couldn't have. Some were. I mean, there are some stories of slaves told who actually, I've just been talking about state slaves. They probably had it worse. But private slaves, some of them actually got along quite well. The best relationship, apparently, that people could hope to have, the best master people could hope to have, would be like a Turk in the military. And the Turks were usually there as part of the military garrison. And if you got a Turkish sergeant or a low officer in the ranks, you could get along with him, and you could sort of end up being his man. You know, you could sort of like in the contemporary European military, you could be his serving man, and he could treat you pretty well, you know, and the Turks liked often to socialize, get drunk, hang around. They didn't have much to do. They were just a garrison. Every now and then they have to go out and attack the Berbers. But as such, they could treat you pretty well, because they were, the Turks are very cosmopolitan and open-minded kind of people in many ways. So that could work all right, and you could be valued. But in many other cases, no, as you can see, they wouldn't even feed you. You were, and the stories, which of course are embellished and no doubt seem are made worse than they probably really were, but we don't really know. But in any case, the stories are pretty bad. One of the most striking in some ways, I think, is one of the last. It was written by an American named John Foss, an actual American. He was captured in 1791 and was a slave for about 4 or 5 years. And it's interesting to notice that he has a list, because he was involved in the complex business of when the Americans were willing to pay ransom, and we paid a lot of ransom in those first years of the Republic. He's got this list, and he's marked off the people. He's got all the crews from about 10 ships that were captured around the time of his ship, and he's got them all marked, of those who lived and those who died in captivity. And about, I can't remember the number, about 25% died in captivity. mostly from disease. And this is late. This is late. This is, he claims to have seen a graveyard outside of Algiers in which he said was 90,000 people, Christians, buried. He claims. I don't know how he knows this, but that's what he claims. So it was more likely than, or not, you know, those are the people that died. And only because the United States came along with this vast amount of money and bought them out. And as I recall, ransoming slaves was one of, I don't remember the numbers, but one of the major expenses in the U.S. Treasury for the first 10 years of the Republic until 1803.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Not only were we paying all this ransom, we were also paying money not to pay ransom. And the reason we went to war in Tripoli was because the Tripolitan government demanded the same rates we were paying to the Tunisian government. So it's not like, you know, we were defending. We were not able to continue our payoffs is what really happened. That's not in the song, I know, but that's kind of the story. But the upshot is that it did allow the other people to get out. Otherwise, they probably would have just died there.
Now, were religious conversions either way occurring, or some Muslims becoming Christians and vice versa?
It is, as you may, if you're following the news at all, it was forbidden for Muslims to convert. And anybody who converted could be executed by Sharia law, and anybody who tried to convert them could be executed. One of my main sources of information in all this, one of the most fascinating to me, has been, and I got these in the Vatican. The Vatican had a huge missionary arm called Propaganda Fide, the Collegio di Propaganda Fide, or known as the Propaganda. And their job was to missionize all over the world. Many of them were Capuchin friars or Franciscans or Jesuits, other groups. And they were very frustrated. I mean, they went many places, and I've seen some of their stuff from India, from China, Japan, less so Japan, but other places. And they were very frustrated because they could not proselytize to Muslims. It was so anybody who was sent to Algiers, it was nice and close to Rome. It wasn't like going around the world, but anybody who went there was in serious danger. You couldn't even be thought to be thinking about converting people. You couldn't even convert to Christianity Christians who had converted to Islam, if you follow that.
Mm-hmm.
That was considered, turning one of the faithful away from the faith. Consequently, anyone who converted and tried to convert back, even people, and there are stories that are popular among Spanish missionaries because they're martyrdom stories, a great Christian tradition. Anyone who tried to, who had converted and said, no, I was wrong, I don't want to convert, he was in serious danger as well. Anyone who changed their mind, in other words. And there were stories of people being horribly executed for this. So that direction did not happen. However, it's interesting to notice that Muslims were basically, of course, they were probably afraid, but Muslims, even when they could convert, did not convert very often. It was not a very, and we know this because large numbers of Muslims were taken, slaves, and those numbers are almost as high as the ones in Barbary, were taken to Rome, Naples, and especially Malta. Malta was a huge slave entrepot that involved literally hundreds of thousands of Muslim slaves went through there. And those people, most of them in either the shipbuilding or the ship rowing or the household slave capacity, were not very likely to convert, even when given the opportunity. There are stories, especially among women, who may have had a more reasons and felt less likely to ever be ransomed. But one of the problems, of course, if you do convert on either side, is that no one's going to ransom you back. And that kind of ends that opportunity, that hope, which is maybe thin, but at least it's a hope. So if you convert, you better be sure you want to be converted. Now, having said that, lots of Christians converted. There were stories of Spanish shiploads of Spanish soldiers that were captured, and the whole ship would convert before they even reached Algiers. So people seem to have rather some people seem to have rather tenuous hold.
It's just
on
that
their
easy,
religion.
Huh? just
that easy. Well,
jump
they
ship
used
right
to
here.
Say, Yeah, I have no idea if it's true, but they used to say that, I've seen this several places, that all it took to become a Muslim was to hold up your right finger, right index finger, and say there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. That was enough. And many people who wrote various kinds of narratives, also missionary narratives, would say, would they write out the words in sort of doggerel Arabic, that you're, what you're supposed to say. And that supposedly was enough. Then you could go through other later steps, which would sort of, for men, culminate in circumcision, which was meant to be like, that would sort of prove it, whether you really meant it or not. But it was not necessary to do all that. You didn't have to know Arabic. You didn't have to know the Quran. Zip. Now, a lot of people did this, supposedly like the Spanish soldiers, thinking they would get them out of slavery on the assumption that no Muslim would enslave another Muslim, and they were wrong. You would be a slave. It was also believed that at least you wouldn't have to do the really nasty stuff. If you were converted, you could at least, like, instead of being a galley oarsman, you could be a guy with a whip. Well, that sounds more attractive, I guess.
It almost sounds like slavery was a whole lot simpler in the pagan days before the Abrahamic religions complicated things some more.
Yeah, it was kind of questionable. The thing is that as I say, if you converted as a Christian, you would have great difficulty coming back. People would be less likely to ransom you, but also you could not unconvert. So you were sort of caught both ways. And there are stories of people escaping, and this is one thing that struck me with the very first thing, as I was telling you, in Venice, these stories. I said, I converted, but I had to. They beat me. They made me convert. And they, having forced him to convert. Now, I was just, and also they said, I was young. I needed the money, you know, whatever. So they plead their innocence and their youth and the force. And the Christians will usually let them come back if they escape. They won't pay for them very often, but they can't. I mean, if they're still officially Muslims in Algeria or Tunis, and they say they want to get out, they say they want to go back to Christianity, the Turks won't let them. But if they escape and then the Christians get a hold of them, then they will allow them to convert back.
Always converting, and because, I mean, Christianity wasn't even that old. They were pagans for thousands of years, and it was also convert or die. So then here they are again, convert or die.
Yeah, convert or die is pretty much what it was. It was, but once you converted, you can't unconvert. That's the thing I want to stress. So it was very difficult. But, you know, as I say, all this money is very laboriously raised to release captives and slaves, and they are very, very careful that those are the people they release. And when they bring them back, I discovered they bring them back to Venice or other places, they have to go through this long quizzing. Did you ever give up? Did you stop being a Christian? Did you curse the faith? Stuff like that. Because they don't want to spend their money on people. Well, they're also worried about their souls. Don't forget, we tend to emphasize more the soul, at least we tend to emphasize more the money than the soul. For people back then, it was quite clearly possible you'd rather die than convert. You know, the belief was so strong that if you converted, you would go to hell, mm-hmm. that they would not let go of that. But there are other cases. I found cases of people who I found one, a Jewish guy who converted to Islam, then converted to Christianity, then went back to Judaism, then went back to Christianity. And finally, the Christians just executed him. They couldn't take him anymore. he converted at least four times, and he didn't seem to have any real sense one way or the other. He didn't really care. So it makes it difficult. I decided to call them faith slaves, in fact, instead of race slaves, to distinguish them from race slaves, because the faith seems to play such an important role in the whole process.
Yeah, and race slaves is also debatable anyway. It's more about talents and abilities.
But the whole idea, they did not take people because they were, because of their race.
Sure.
And they are darker, it's true, but Turks are not that dark. Berbers are, you know, but there's none. It's not very clear cut who people are racially. And then a lot of people, Islam is particularly open to converts, a lot of them, as I say, this guy that attacked Iceland was a Dutch renegade, and a lot of other famous ship captains were renegades. I once saw a list of in the 1580s of galleys in Algiers, and I think there's about 30 galleys. I think about 18 of them were captained by renegades, or maybe even more than that. A large number, even a majority of them, were captained by renegades. So you could rise up in the world, and some of the most famous of all the famous corsairs were renegades, and ended up with huge palaces in Istanbul, living the soft life and with their harems and their music and stuff. So Islam, and this is not something you hear about happening among Muslims who go to Christianity. They're not so well treated, by and large. They're treated as curiosities.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, you discovered while writing this book, there was a high amount of slaving that took place in modern-day Poland, Ukraine, Russia, and the Caucasus. So tell us about this. What did you discover?
Oh, that. Well, it's kind of tricky. I didn't discover that much. I alluded to it because it's one of the things that really is a stumbling block for this research is the number of languages involved. And I contented myself, if that's the word, with Romance languages. I can't do Greek. I can't do Polish, Russian, Albanian. So I really don't know the exact details. But from what I understand, there is a long border. It was shifting. It was never very well fixed, even over centuries, between what is essentially now Ukraine, divided between the Turks and the Russians, Ukrainians, and Lithuanians. And that border extends on down between Budapest and Vienna, on down to include what was Yugoslavia, to the Adriatic coast, down to Venice. And along that whole land border, there were constant raids back and forth by various groups of people, Cossacks on the Russian side, and there were, what were they called? There were also Turkish, or the Muslim raiders, whose names elude me right now, from what is now Chechnya, essentially, still a Muslim area. And they constantly pulled slaves out from the Christian world. I also discovered at a conference I was at last year, they pulled out a lot of Jews. Really, thousands of Jews were taken from Poland and Lithuania and hauled off to Istanbul. The numbers are anybody's guess. Anybody's guess. No one. This is one of the great things yet to be studied, and it's not that people don't want to study it. It's just really, really hard. And the records, the Turkish records, are not very easy. You realize that the Turks communicated in a language which doesn't exist anymore. Essentially, Ottoman Turkish is in a different alphabet. It involves words and stuff that modern Turks don't use. And it is extremely hard to learn. You have to know Persian, Arabic, and Turkish all at once. So reading their documents is hard. And to throw in, if you also have to know Lithuanian, you can imagine. And the Lithuanians, you know, and that whole area has been destroyed so many times by war that it's very difficult to put it together. But my guess would be several million people were taken out of there over the course of the years. And I think if we throw that in, And we know, and no one's really studied, that I know of at least, no one's really studied the slave population of enormous cities like Cairo, which were huge. They're one of the largest cities in the world. They must have had many, many slaves there. I think I've got one story of some English slaves in Alexandria. I have one story of some people in Port Said, sort of in the where the Suez Canal is, and then these stories of Cairo. I don't have nothing. There's no information. So this is all waiting to be done.
Well, from what you know, when and how did the decline of Christian slavery begin to happen?
Fair question. The decline happens. It's really quite odd because it's going great guns. And what you basically have, remember I said in the beginning that these American and Mediterranean slavery start pretty much at the same time. American slavery takes off kind of slowly over the course of the 16th century. The Spanish basically have to wipe out all the available Indian population for labor. And it's only in the later part of the century that increasing numbers of of Africans start being brought over. But by contrast, because of the nature of the warfare going on in the Mediterranean, the slave taking among Christians in Europe goes up fast and peaks out probably somewhere around 1580 to 1620. And then it sort of stagnates for a while. Then it gets kind of unclear. The numbers are hard to really guess. We have some populations from some cities. Some people dispute those populations hotly, say it's impossible, they couldn't be there. Some people, like me, think they're probably more or less true. And then sometime around 1680, they start to diminish. Could be a number of reasons why this happens. In other words, we're looking at about a 180-year spread. A couple of reasons this could happen. One is quite simply, the galley stops being an important part of Mediterranean warfare. It takes the Turks, and for that matter, it takes the Venetians a while to catch up with changing technology. But eventually they move over to using full-rigged ships, which cannot so easily be run by slaves. So the need for these ships that have 100, 200 slaves in them begins to disappear. Some of the ships still exist right up to the time of Napoleon, but they're basically on the way out. And then I've seen statements that already by 1700 that there are virtually no more galleys. There's a huge placement of labor that disappears. So that's one reason. And there's just not that kind of incentive. At the same time, the British and the French, first of all, start organizing themselves to combat the slavery. This goes back as far as the 1620s. The British come and try and attack Algiers. They're under particular problems. There's a huge story about the Moroccans and Algerians attacking the coast of Britain that is almost completely forgotten in history, but it's coming back now thanks to British historians. But the British feel we can't take this. We need some kind of revenge. And their idea of revenge is to go down and try and blow the hell out of Algiers, which they do unsuccessfully. They don't accomplish anything. It goes back and forth until finally, 60 years later, in 1680, the French come down with this newly invented weapon called the mortar, which allows you to shoot a bomb, basically, from a ship onto land. And they proceed to mortar the entire city of Algiers in kill vast numbers of people and blow up buildings. And the Algerians respond by strapping slaves, not slaves, I'm sorry, they strap missionaries. Slaves are worth money. They strap missionaries across cannon and blow them apart as a kind of retaliation. But eventually the Algerians go, okay, we give up. And they let the French, they don't free the French slaves, they sell the French slaves back at cost. But all this really does at first is they go, well, let's find somebody else we can attack. First, they attack the Dutch who were there. Then the Dutch signed a treaty. Then they attack the Germans who are down there in some numbers. But they never stop attacking the Spanish and the Italians. And it takes, this goes on right through into the 1800s. But the numbers go down. It continues, but at a steadily decreasing rate. And so we have what may be a maximum number of slaves in North Africa, maybe 35,000 slaves at any one time, diminishes by, and that's in about 1620. By 1720, it's down to about 7,000. By the end of the 18th century, it's down to about 3,000 maybe. So small numbers, and then it sort of peters out and finally disappears completely.
Well, last question for you. I know you've been talking and I don't want to use up all your voice, but
My voice is gone. Go for it.
Well, as you know, the truth of white slavery, it's dismissed by scholars as some post-colonialism guilt, which is bullshit, I think. And there are many political motives behind this. But what reactions have you received from your peers since writing on this topic?
Yeah. It's many reactions. One is envy, having found a really hot topic. This got me into all the magazines and whatnot, which is always nice. And you're calling me 11 years after the first book came out of the two that I wrote. So it has some staying power. It also, I was lucky enough to tag into the beginning of something which is now actually fairly widespread, and their interest in it is considerable. And the research goes along with it. So that's nice. But on the other hand, there is a feeling that this should not be. I get this sense that this is not the narrative that we should be telling about Europeans. Europeans are masters. They're not slaves, by and large, in history. And we see this beginning to change. And now we're seeing stories about Europeans enslaving other Europeans, sending them to the Caribbean, sending them to the Americas, sending them to Australia. So the use of forced labor is being recognized as something which isn't really connected to religion, isn't really connected to anything except the ability to do it, the ability to carry out enslavement. And so it seems to me that the reaction, and in that regard, people are now starting to accept it more. But in the beginning, there was some disbelief. I remember going to seminars, presenting papers, and people were saying, "This is impossible. I've never heard of this." Somebody once quite literally said to me, "I've never heard of this. How can it be?" And the one problem is that Mediterranean studies in the 17th and 18th, well, the 16th, 17th, and 18th century has never been was for a long time not a main focus of study, or at least the 17th century. The French did some, a lot actually, Fernand Braudel, among others. But what I'm saying is it's kind of a neglected area. But neglected areas, like neglected real estate, tend to attract people eventually. Grad
That's
students
right.
looking for new projects, people. And so it has bit by bit. And now I'm seeing books on slavery among Greeks, for example, on people working in Albania, and odd places are starting to turn up. It's kind of a thing. It's kind of caught on, and people now are more accepting of it. But they weren't happy in the beginning, and it's still very difficult to convince the Muslim world that this is something we're studying. They think, I've gotten the reaction from people that this is anti-Islamic somehow. I don't quite see how, frankly. I mean,
well, history and truth is now deemed racist and offensive. See,
well, it is. It's not just. It's anti-Islam goes deeper than just being racist. It is an attack on religion, and yet, I once pointed out to somebody. I said, you should be kind of proud of this, shouldn't you? And actually, somebody once pointed out to me as well. You know, we did this. You know, we were the terror of the sea. And in fact, it's interesting that the Turkish Navy to this day has a ship called the Barbarossa. They are proud of this guy, and there are other names of even more feared corsairs who are honored in Istanbul to this day, and there are statues of them and stuff. So, in fact, there's a Barbarossa actually built a mosque to himself in a tomb in Istanbul. So there's a, you know, I think that everybody should embrace their history, good or bad. Well, maybe not the Nazis, I don't know, but, you know, it's...
Sorry, I just wanted to interrupt here. Actually, I urge you to look into revisionist history surrounding World War II and the Nazis, because we have to remember that history is written by the victor, and wartime propaganda exists. And as you've said, some things don't fit into the current narrative.
Well, one of the things that the difference is that makes it difficult is that as you come up to the 20th century, there's just too much history. I mean, there are too many sources. There's too much material out there. And so it's very difficult to come up with this is the definitive answer.
Sure, yeah.
I'm working in a period where there's just nothing. I mean, for example, actual slave accounts, slave sales records and so forth in the city of Algiers basically don't exist before 1750, when it's already pretty much over. The time you really want to know about, the time that really big volume, when slaves were worth an onion, there's nothing. So we're kind of in the dark. At the same time, in the 18th century, the American slave records are enormous. Just tens of thousands of ledgers, books, insurance records, sales records, you name it, it's all there. And that's why it's been possible to do so much more study on American slavery. But when you're in the 20th century, you got so many records that I wouldn't go there. it's terrifying. But anyway, I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, please tell us about your books, website, and any other info you'd like to include.
Well, I'm not working so much on slavery anymore. I've moved off and working on bandits. We were kind of like corsairs on land, and Italy was extremely troubled by bandits in the 16th century, and so I'm finding this a fascinating area to move on. Although I am writing actually a Western Civ textbook that tells the whole story of Europe. Well, I've written it actually from 1600 to the present. So actually I have written about the Nazis lately and about what's happening in Russia right now and stuff like that. So I just wrote a piece on Pussy Riot, in fact, if you're familiar with them, the rock group. But I don't have a website, just at OSU. Dot edu. There's a history page website. If anyone wants to look me up. Also, I have a page on Amazon where all my books are, or most of my books, not all of them. So does that help? I don't know.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, yeah. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you, and good evening.
Well, folks. Usually, when you hear the word slavery, American plantation slavery has become the archetype in people's minds. You probably just pictured it in your mind right now. Hollywood loves to perpetuate this image ad nauseum, as though only blacks were slaves. But guess what? The institution of slavery is ancient and has never been limited to a particular race. Not one group can own slavery as their own, no one is more of a victim, and no one deserves money because of it. Meanwhile, slaves in India and Africa still exist. Radio314.com or RedIceCreations.com are the websites where you can find our radio archives and more. Find Radio 314 on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Stitcher, iTunes, and on RSS. And a big thanks to our Red Ice members who helped make our website possible. Thank you. Have a pleasant night, and we'll talk again soon.